Thank you, Jennifer. My name is Gay Garner, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and grateful to be a privilege to be in your group. I'll tell you, I don't know if y'all are aware of it, but your reputation has really cut a road through Atlanta, you know, and you're to be congratulated because we sure do need, I'm an old-timey AA, and we sure do need that punch, and I consider it a privilege to be invited to come to your group. Thank you, and thank you for the message that you carry. My sobriety date is March the 14th, 1976. I am a member of the Clarkston 12-Step Group. My sponsor was Cindy T., who was my sponsor for 33 years of my sobriety. She passed away last year, but like a good AA, I have another sponsor already, and her name is Marge, and she got sober in New Jersey and is a transplant down here, and she's wonderful. God has blessed me. When I came into the program, there were not a lot of women in this side of town, so the pickings were very short on trying to find women sponsors, so somebody gave me Cindy T's telephone number. She was from North Atlanta, and I met her at Waffle House off of 285 and didn't know her from Adam's House Cat. Asked her if she would help me get sober, and she said yes. And we were together all that time until she made her transition out of the world. But she was wonderful. She was a solid old-time AA. She was into the solution. She was always available. I could call her anytime I needed her, and she was there. And I never came away from any kind of conversation with Cindy that I did not have direction, and I did not have a step to hone in on, and I did not have a solution. And I never knew that morning when I sat in that Waffle House how God had blessed me with her. And I have once again been blessed by Marge. She's a wonderful AA, into the same things that Cindy were. And I sponsor quite a few women, and I try to give back to them what those gals gave to me. And it's been just a marvelous experience. I love being an alcoholic. I love being sober. I love being here. I want to introduce my husband, Al. Al is a... Al's a big part of my story. I thought for a long, long time he was the cause of my story. But, of course, you know, that's the wonderful thing about AA. You know what? You come into AA and they take all those blaming boards away from you and make you look at yourself. And I wouldn't have given you 2 cents for the marriage. And my mother used to say, you know, if you ever had him where you wanted him, you wouldn't want him. And I thought that was kind of unkind, but she was right. She was right. I finally, after 18 years of alcoholism and 5 years of sobriety, finally got him where I wanted him, and of course I didn't want him then. And he went to Al-Anon. Our stories are a little reversed, and he went to Al-Anon. He's a wonderful Al-Anon. His story is a wonderful miracle, just like mine is. He has changed his life through the steps and the traditions and service work in Al-Anon. And I can't think. I spent 18 years obsessed with making this marriage work. I really thought that was my main problem. And then I spent 5 years getting sober, and then I spent 5 years trying to get rid of him. And I couldn't get rid of him. And now I am so happy to tell you that there isn't anybody that I would rather be in the world with than Al Gardner. He is a wonderful, principled person. And, we are really blessed. We are really, really blessed. We last month celebrated 52 years of marriage. So I always like to say that really shows you how sick Al was, because he spent 18 years with an alcoholic woman. And, you know, his saving grace was that he traveled a lot, so he wasn't home much. Anyway, I really do appreciate the invitation of being here, and I am a member of Clarkston. I love that group. It started out as I'm one of the original members, and I'm the only living member that's left from that group that started all that time, and I love it. We have a hope you come there. I'm sure many of you have been to Clarkston. It's a wonderful phenomenon of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I share about Clarkston, my home group, and tell them how it works, it's kind of like that upside-down triangle that people see in the service structures and say, no way could that work. Well, we have 49 meetings. We have one secretary, one GSR, one intergroup rep. And everybody says, how can that work? Well, it works, and it just works beautifully. And I'm really proud to be a member there. As I'm able to look back in my life on this wonderful process of inventory, which I didn't know a thing about doing that kind of stuff. You know, the 12 and 12 tells us wise people have always known to inventory their lives. Well, I certainly did not fall into that category. And, Katie, I want to tell you how much I enjoyed your story, your short story. I have to tell you, it's such a small world. My daughter, Allison, who is a member of the fellowship, went and sat in court all day long with Katie one time. So, you know, she came and told me that when I got in there, and I can hardly wait to talk to Allison tonight and tell her I met one of the girls, and that Allison is wonderful. She's very, very active in her program. She does a lot of work with the young girls, and boy, are we glad that she is sober. I want to tell you a little bit of my family. My story is very much like Katie's. I came from, everybody in my family was alcoholic. Everybody. But they were not cruel and mean drunks. They were loving people. There was never any doubt in my mind that I was not loved by my parents. I came from a family that had a lot of social standing and money, so I had an awful lot of opportunity offered to me. And as I'm able to look back on my life was pretty good. I'm kind of like that story in the big book that says that person that feels like they got the world by the tail. And I was just really happy. When I went through the inventory process, I did find a lot of things, like my inability to form a true and lasting relationship. I left high school at the age of 18 with kids that I had gone to school with, that I'd gone to scouts with, that I'd gone to Sunday school with, and all that. And I never had one interconnection with one person. I went back to a 40th class reunion and had several people say to me, "Oh, you always wondered what happened to you. It's like you just fell off the side of the earth." And it did. I just, when I left, I was gone. And it seemed to me that I was always surrounded by a lot of people. And it was the same thing was true with Allison in my life. Allison in broadcasting, and he's retired now, but he was in broadcasting, and we were always around a lot of people. Always seemed to move into neighborhoods where there was a lot of partying, a lot of fun. It always appeared we had a lot of friends, but you know, when it was time to go, we were gone. And there was never that interconnection with another human being. So I was able to discover that about myself when I got sober. Also, the fact Bill talks a lot in the big book about separating fantasy from reality. I was a great fantasy person. I just lived in fantasy all the time. I grew up in the age of the great movies and the era of the musicals and stuff. And I lived in the movie theater. I loved it. And back in those days, everything ended up right. It's not like the movies and the things today, sex and violence and all that stuff. This was all wonderful love and singing. And Esther Williams was swimming all over the place. And so I grew up with the notion that the boy gets the girl. They live happily ever after, and that's the end of the story, you know. And I totally, really believed that. As funny as that seems to me today, but I really did believe that. I was an excellent student, straight-A student. I graduated from high school on three honor societies with several scholarships throughout the country. I had a musical ability that got me into a lot of things. I am a fast lane traveler. I can't talk as fast as Katie does, but anyway, I traveled in that fast lane all the time. And I think a lot of that, and I have to be careful of it today because I'm still a fast lane traveler, although I'm not as young as I used to be. But when you travel in that fast lane, most of the time you don't ever stop and take stock and trade of what's going on in your life. You're just on to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. So I was always in the fast lane. I'm a jazz musician. I was into everything in school. I left at the age of 18 years old to go to New York City to study music at Juilliard. And I got up there, and it seemed to me up until this period of time, although there were those things I told you about in my life that were not, you know, as normal people live, but I was very happy. I mean, it was like I had come into what I had wanted to always do. And I went to Juilliard, And I went to work right away playing in cocktail lounges. I'm a jazz pianist. And life seemed to be very good for me. There were a couple things that happened to me while I was in New York. I had been approached by several prostitution rings to see if they wanted, if I wanted to join, and I was not really interested in that. And then I also got myself involved with a married man. I did not know he was married at the time, but found out through a series of events. And I was also offered drugs on a daily basis and alcohol. Now, I had had my first drink, but not drinking to drink. I just had had a taste of alcohol. And I've always had kind of a naivety, Bill also talks about that, that has never served me very well and still does not serve me very well. And I found it necessary in the late, in the middle 50s, when the world was a little bit more friendly to live in than it is today, I found it necessary to share all that with my mom and dad. So after I'd shared with them about the prostitution and the married man and the drug offerings and everything like that, the next thing I knew, my dad appeared in New York. And, we went back to his hotel room, and we had a father and daughter talk. And, of course, you know, he said, I don't want you to live like this. I don't want you to, because it would be just a matter of time before you would be involved in it. It would be a part of your life. And he said, I'd like for you to come home and go to school and meet a nice young man and get married and live happily ever after. And, of course, that's what I wanted to do anyway. So I bought the deal, and I was to return home with him. Now, I really thought for a long time that that was my undoing. If he had just left me alone and let me stay in New York and finish my studies and work and become a famous musician, then everything would have been okay. But he didn't let me stay there. So my life after New York never went well. Also, I learned after I got sober and was able to start getting a little bit honest, the thing about the New York trip was this is where I really, alcohol became a part of my life. I was going around with my agent auditioning for some jobs. The drunk followed pretty quickly after the starting to drink in the bars. And I was living with a maiden aunt, and I got very drunk and got very sick, and but I made it home, and she asked me what was wrong with me, and I told her I'd eaten something that had not agreed with me. So I, instead of the dishonesty, I began lying about my drinking. And from the very beginning, that seemed to be one of the uppermost things in my drinking, was there were a couple things. I seemed to be able to hold an enormous capacity of alcohol until toward the end when I didn't have any capacity left at all. And the constant lying, even when it wasn't even necessary. The whole time that I really was into my alcoholism at home and drinking alone, nobody was around, Al was out of town, the kids were in school and everything, and I'm hiding the bottles and, you know, watering down the booze and all this stuff. So, you know, I heard somebody say from the pudding one time, we really do that to satisfy ourselves and not really anybody else. So anyway, after I got home, my parents had relocated to North Carolina, and I enrolled in Wake Forest College. I was in Wake Forest at that time, was a small college, and it was run by the Baptist State Convention, so I don't have to tell you, there was not a lot of exciting stuff going on campus. You could not even hold hands on campus. And the professors actually walked around with rulers and measured that you were, your shoulders were 6 inches apart as you were walking down the hall, so it wasn't a lot of fun. But I immediately fell in with, I think, the five people that drank. And they were all in the theater, and of course that was my outlet for music. And Al was a part of that group. Al was in the theater group, so that's how I met Al, and we started to date. And I got pregnant, and that came from a little bit more, I guess, than holding hands and walking 6 inches apart, you know, down the hallway. But anyway, it was a horrible time for me and a horrible time for my family. They were so ashamed. This is in the 50s, mid-50s, and it was really socially outcast type of a deal during that period of time. I mean, your choices were you either went to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers, or you went to some back alley place and got an abortion. Those were your choices. Or you had the baby and gave it up for adoption. Well, I don't believe anybody asked Al and I, you know, how we felt about anything. Now, Al was in his last year of law school at Wake Forest. And my mother, who was quite a powerful personality, made all the arrangements for us to be married. This was the first time that I had really had thoughts of suicide, thoughts of running away and that kind of stuff, and that total inability to take responsibility for my actions. You know, sitting around thinking, how could that have happened to me, you know, when we know exactly how that happened to me. But anyway, I don't think Al and I were asked what we wanted to do. My mother made the arrangements. And it took me 5 years into sobriety where I realized that that set of circumstances messed Al's life up a little bit. You know, I was so honed into my own life and my own family. And my mother cried. She said I had ruined her life. And my dad cried. And it was just a horrible, horrible experience. And up until I got sober in AA, I was never able to put that situation in its proper perspective. I really had that sick, perverse ego sense that I had really ruined their lives. And I carried that with me for years, that one set of circumstances had ruined their lives. Well, Al and I were married, and we were sent down to, it was arranged so that nobody would know what had happened, that we go down and we lived in a small town called Stark, Florida. I don't know if any of you know where that is, but that's a little podunk town outside of Jacksonville. So that's how Al and I started our lives, and the marriage was a disaster. And I was so, you know, I had this fantasy that I was going off into the sunset and live happily ever after. Well, it was sure a different story than that. And I began on this pursuit to make this thing work. I was obsessed with it and nearly drove everybody nuts around me with it. And it just seemed like the harder I tried to make it work, the worse it got. But that was the beginning of such a great disappointment to me. But I became obsessed that, you know, I'm going to wake up Monday morning and it's going to be okay. Or if I just work a little bit harder on this thing, I can make it okay. If I could just get him to love me, I would be okay. Our story really kind of sounds a little bit Al-Anon-y and AA from a reverse side. Al was starting to do all those things that alcoholics do out there in the world. And I was at home trying so hard to hold the family together. We had three daughters. I want to tell you a little bit about my immediate family. We do have three daughters. This year for me has been kind of a time when I have found out that I really don't know as much as I think I know. I mean, I think I have things in their proper place, and then all of a sudden something happens, and they're not in their proper place anymore. I am a believer that alcoholism is a family disease and that nobody escapes the effects of alcoholism in the family. But we have, Al and I have three daughters. The oldest one, Julie, I thought had escaped the ravagings of alcoholism. Now, Julie has just turned 50. Now, Julie, for years and years and years, sipped on a half a glass of wine. Now, about a year ago, Julie started drinking martinis. And it has been downhill ever since. So she is really on her way, I think, to join us here. Of course, that's, you know, I don't say anything to her, but she knows she's been to all my birthdays. She's been to the other girls' birthdays and things. So she's pretty aware of where the answer is, if indeed that she were to need it. Lori, our middle daughter, has been in and out of AA and NA for 30-some years. She's like a cat with nine lives. She gets sober and stays sober for a while. And she had a botched surgery here a while back and ended up very sick in the hospital for 3 months with peritonitis, and we had lost her. She had 13 years of sobriety, and she got hooked on the pills. And we put her down at Anchor to get her off the pills. And they gave her something. I don't know what it was. Tony Curry talked at Clarkson last weekend, and she was wonderful. And she talked a lot how some of those psychiatrists and psychologists do believe that the answer is in the pills, and they're very free to give out the pills. Well, Lori left there on some pills, and in 6 weeks, she was on the streets. And in a couple months, she was in the mental institute up in Rome. And She came back home. She couldn't even put a sentence together. I thought we'd lost her again. But she got it together, got out of the mental institute, came and stayed with Al and I for a while, got her life together, got a job, got everything got back again. And then it was just a matter of time and she was back out again. So she's had periods of being sober, and then she's had her periods of slipping and going back again. So, you know, she's constantly in our prayers. Allison is also a member of AA, and she's the one that sat Katie in court. And she's also a member of NA, and she has 6 years in AA, and she's going to celebrate her 5 years tomorrow night in NA. So we're very proud of her. She has just turned into a wonderful, wonderful young lady, and very smart, has her own business, and works a lot with the young girls, and the program sponsors several people, and is she's just a wonderful young lady. We're really very proud of her. Well, life went on for Al and I. I don't remember drinking as a particular problem. We drank a lot, but I don't remember drinking on the outside becoming quite a problem. But I was in a lot of trouble inside because I was so unhappy and the marriage was so bad and I couldn't get it to work. So I began on a series of things of trying to find things to make me feel better. Of course, the alcohol did its thing, but I also started reading all the self-help books I could get my hands on, and I tried everything that they suggested I do. And another thing I learned about myself was that, you know, if I'm into something and if it's not working in 24 hours, I'm on to something else. I have no patience at all with that kind of stuff. So when the first self-help book didn't work, I'm on to the second one. Then I'm on to the third one, and so on and so forth. And I did the same thing with churches. I thought, well, maybe there's an answer for me in the church. I had gone to church. I didn't come from a family that went to church a lot, but I had gone as a small kid to church all the time. And so I tried all the major churches and then a few of the minor ones. And when it didn't work in 24 hours, I was off trying to find something else. Now, when I got my sponsor, Cindy was very quick to point out to me that there is no first step in self-help books or churches. So, therefore, I don't stand a chance of recovery until I get someplace where that first step is practiced and I'm able to put the drink down so I can hear what's being said. So, anyway, that was pretty much my pattern. I am a housewife drunk. You will hear a lot of people feel sorry for us because nothing exciting ever happens to us. When I came in and finally got sober, the women's stories that I heard, and there were not an awful lot of them, but I did have some tapes, were absolutely horrible. And I had not known how to identify with the inside stuff. I was identifying with all the outside stuff, you know, the people waking up with strange people in strange places across the country and all that kind of stuff. So I really had a hard time with the identification until I began to learn that it was the inside stuff, you know, that I really needed to be listening to and I needed to be identifying with. So anyway, life went on for us, and I was in a lot of trouble, and I tried all these things, and nothing seemed to help. I had developed a relationship with my mother. She became my higher power for many years, and I know the reason for that today through working the program is that because she just thought I was so special, and she told me that. We had a mutual admiration thing going. I would tell her how wonderful she was, and then she would tell me how wonderful I was. And it worked. It worked. I really needed that. That was my validity for being on the earth. And there was a lot of good stuff going on in my life. I had three children, wonderful kids. I had a lovely house, car, had all that stuff, you know, that we find is important, you know, to survive, but it's not the most important thing in life as we learn when we get sober. So anyway, I had a lot of good stuff going on, but I was just so devastated by this marriage. And so my mother would come visit me, and we'd talk about it to each other about how wonderful we thought each other were. We'd have a lot of drinks, and we'd listen to a lot of jazz, and just, you know, that was kind of what kept me going for a really long time. We had moved to Houston. Al was in radio, and of course, in order to get ahead in radio, I'm really watching the clock. John, you said 8:25? Yeah, 25 minutes. Okay, I'm watching. You watch for me. You just hold up your hand if I go over. So Al was working, had gotten a job promotion. We moved to Houston, Texas. And when he was on the air, a famous entertainer came through. And he was having kind of a rough time getting play on the air. And Al helped him. And he kind of adopted Al. And he said that his dream had been to set up a series of radio stations throughout the country. And he wanted Al to come run them. So Al, the first one to be set up was in Knoxville, Tennessee. So we moved to Knoxville. And by this time, I'm really pretty much into the drinking. I think I was just getting ready, or I had just crossed the line. But some things happened to me at this move in Knoxville. The first thing being, I didn't know how to drive an automobile. I was 30 years old, and I had just never learned, which I think is part of that sick dependency of just expecting somebody else to do for me, but I'm not willing to learn and to do for myself. And, of course, I think Al gave up on trying to teach me how to drive. So my mom came up, and she taught me how to drive. So I learned how to drive. I mean, Al was having to take me to the doctor, to the dentist, to the grocery store, to the thing. I mean, every place I went, you know. And my world was now beginning to get very small. Now that I could drive, the only places that I went is I knew where the kids' schools were, I knew where the liquor store was, I knew where the grocery store was, and I knew where the bank was. And that was my world. That became my world. We moved shortly after that. Oh, the other thing was that I became terrified of nighttime. I don't know, it just seemed like the demons all came out at night. And I would get all the children together, and I would sleep with them. I would put them in the bedroom, lock the door. I had guns, billy clubs, and knives, and would take my arsenal with me. And Al would say, you know, you don't really have to worry about anybody going after you, because if they walk in there and see your arsenal, they're going to be gone. But I slept with that stuff until I got sober. And if you were to ask me what I thought was going to get me, I couldn't have told you. It was just, it was kind of that impending doom feeling that we just seemed to have. I had that impending doom. So anyway, we lived in Knoxville for a while, and then we moved to Augusta for a while and set up a radio station there, and then on to Baltimore. And the curtains were really, by the time I had gotten to Baltimore, I became a daily drinker. And it just happened. I just started drinking daily. By the time I got into Baltimore, I was doing all those things that we as alcoholics seem to need to do. I was hiding bottles. I was watering down booze. I was loading my drinks. I was doing all those things, and there wasn't even anybody at home to do that for, because Al was traveling. Al began to travel, so I was alone a lot with the children. Life went on, and I just drank. I was drinking daily, and I began to have some physical problems. But I got a call on Thanksgiving morning that my mother had died suddenly, and my world just completely fell apart. I started drinking around the clock, and I was just devastated. I just felt like I'd been thrown on the world with nobody and with nothing. And I was getting pretty sick. I had some physical things that began to happen to me after that. My hair all fell out. I still don't have an awful lot today, but it's at one time I didn't have any at all. And I had sores all over my body. And I started having to go make trips to several hospitals and doctors and emergency rooms. I was having this alcoholic neuralgia, is what I later found out what it was, where, you know, the body, the alcohol doesn't assimilate the body like it does in normal people. And my hands and my feet were swelling 3 and 4 times their size. And my throat would close and I couldn't breathe, and they would have to put me on oxygen and everything. And the thing about it is, nobody could seem to find out what was wrong with me, except this one doctor who thought I had an allergy to something. And anyway, I was able to write him a letter after I got sober to let him know exactly what the allergy was that I was suffering from. So anyway, that was kind of the way things were going. Found out my dad came to live with me. He became my drinking partner. My dad is an alcoholic. He became my drinking partner, and our days sort of consisted of sitting around drinking all day long, talking about how we missed my mother and how lucky we had been to have her. I had a box of letters that she had written me while I was in New York, and how what a success she wanted me to be and all that kind of stuff. And I would read those letters, and then I started going to seances and readings, sometimes drunk, sometimes sober, just feeling somewhere down the line if I could just get a hold of her and talk to her, that I would be okay. Of course, that didn't happen. Al began to get into a lot of trouble. The business that he was involved with, the entertainer, got into a lot of trouble. And bank accounts were attached. The IRS were knocking on our door every other day. And lawsuits were all over the place. And we found out that we were going to be moving to Atlanta. Up until this time, I had worked professionally till we got to Baltimore. And but the problem became in Baltimore that I was ending up under the piano more than I was at the piano, so that had to stop. And I just told everybody I couldn't work anymore because the crime rate in Baltimore was so bad. And it was pretty bad, but that was not the main problem why I wasn't working anymore. So I thought we'd get to Atlanta and maybe, you know, new friends, and I'd go back to work again and all that kind of stuff. Well, when we got there, you know, when you're in the throes of alcoholism and the progression of alcoholism, things do not get better. They get worse, and they got worse for me. I got very suicidal. I got a call that my dad had been put in the hospital. He'd come to live with me down Florida. He'd gone on a binge, and I went down to pick him up, and he had talked about maybe doing some meetings or something with me, but he passed away while he was down there. So I was very, very angry. I did not understand, therefore, but for the grace of God. I'd been to my first AA meeting. My grandmother passed away, and I had an opportunity to go back to Omaha, and I stayed with my piano teacher. And she and her husband had been drinking friends with my mom and dad's. And he was 2 years sober in AA, and I had no idea how this was going to impact my life. But anyway, a couple things happened there. I was sitting at the table drinking about 11 o'clock in the morning, and he came by and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "There are no answers for us in that anymore." And I don't remember thinking that that was a momentous statement or anything, but I remembered that the night I called AA. He did not tell me his story, but his wife told me his story, and I thought how wonderful it was that he had been able to come up out of the, you know, black hole of alcoholism, and that never even relating with it or thinking it had anything to do with me. So he took me to the airport after the funeral of my grandmother, and he held my hand the whole way out to the plane. That was long ago enough that you walked out to the plane instead of like we do today. And I was very nervous. I couldn't, and the whole time I had been there, he kept touching me. He touched my hand, my arm, and my face, and all that kind of stuff. And later, after I did get sober and talk with him, I talked about that because I knew, I felt like something was going on, and I just didn't quite know what it was. And he said, "That was my exchange with you of spiritual energy. I was giving you some of my spiritual energy." And when he said, "That's what we do in AA when we hold hands and when we hug and all that kind of stuff. That's a spiritual energy connection." And when my kids were in such trouble, he told me to do that every time I had an opportunity, you know, to hug them and to know mentally in my mind that I was giving them an exchange of spiritual energy. And it really helped me a lot. And he tagged it as a piece of action. And it is a piece of action, and it made me feel better when I was able to do that. We got back to Atlanta. Al opened the office. Things did not get better. I got very suicidal. Al was carrying a large sums of money at that time with him, and he also had a loaded gun that he carried with him. And the crowning blow was that my father's bank account was attached because my name was on it because of some business dealings with Al. And I was just devastated, and I called my sister, and I just went back to the bedroom, got the gun down, and sat there and played with it for a little while. I was pretty drunk, but I was putting the gun in my mouth and putting it in my head and everything. And I later found out that my 12-year-old daughter was in the doorway watching me do all this. And it left her with some pretty bad scars for a pretty long time. She had nightmares for years, and I would get a call in the middle of the night saying, "Mom, I had that dream again, and you pulled the trigger, and, you know, are you okay? Are you okay?" Well, I haven't had any calls from her in the last 3 or 4 years, so I really feel that it has finally healed itself. But, you know, there's just some things that repercussions from alcoholism that we learn, that we live with. the damage that we had done. I was one who came in and thought that the only person that I had ever hurt was myself. And it took a series of inventories and a lot of meetings listening to other people share that I realized the emotional damage. Even though I was a housewife drunk, the emotional damage that I had done to my children. And I've done several sets of amends because it peels like the onion, and I go deeper and deeper into the damage that I have done. Anyway, I have to remember where I am now. I didn't pull the trigger. I went to the restroom, got a glimpse of myself in the mirror. We were talking about the mirror tonight, which I've heard a lot of alcoholics share from the podium. And the words out of my mouth were, "Oh God, what am I going to do?" Now, I thought for a long time that was just an expression. But after I got sober and began to really have a connection with a power greater than myself, I really realized that it was an ardent prayer and that it was answered. I went to the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know they called me back in a timely order. I called the central office number, but I had passed out when they called back. So the girls took the call and asked if they would please call back the next day, and they did. And I went to my very first meeting in January of 1976 to Glen Haven Stone Mountain in Stone Mountain, Georgia. I don't remember much about what it was. I remember there weren't any women there. I didn't have any phone numbers. I don't remember to talk about sponsorship and everything. But I love what Sandy Beach says. What I saw and what I heard is not necessarily what was going on. So, I mean, what the truth of that is, I don't really know. But anyway, after a while of drinking, and I would go through periods of time where, especially because I couldn't identify with that, the outside stuff that I kept hearing, I kept thinking, well, maybe I belong here and maybe I don't. On the days that I belonged there, I was fine. On the days that I didn't belong there, I would drink again. But the thing that did for me is it planted in my mind the things that I heard in the meeting, like it's the first drink. And I love that paragraph in the 12 and 12. It says, once the nature of the malady is planted in the mind of an alcoholic by another alcoholic, he is never the same. And I think that happened to me, and I think that's the thing that kept drawing me back over and over again when I didn't think that I belonged there. I had some experiences. I had my last drink on March the 14th. I don't know. I would not have picked that date. I had been into numerology and astrology and all that, and 14 is not a very interesting number, but I'm glad that God is a lot wiser than I am. But anyway, that was I had my last drink on the 14th. And somebody told me about a little group that had just started called Clarkston, and it was a step meet. And if you can believe it today, it was the second step meeting in the city. John Flemister had a step meeting downtown, and then Clarkston started the step meeting, and now, of course, thank God for all of us. They are all over the city, but this is the way it was. So anyway, my introduction into Alcoholics Anonymous was with the steps immediately. And I loved when I got sober. Newcomers were not allowed to talk in meetings. So we went and we listened. We were told to listen, that we didn't have anything to share, and that we needed to listen to the old-timers who knew how to get sober. They were the ones that we needed to listen to and share. So you could not share on a step until you had worked it. So we worked the steps pretty quick because we didn't want to have to sit there and not be able to share. So anyway, that was my introduction. So there was never any doubt in my mind, and I loved it because if you had sat in a meeting in the times that I got sober and complained about being an alcoholic, those old-timers would have absolutely torn you apart. You know, you ungrateful thing. Do you know how many people are dying out on the street of alcoholism? And you have been blessed to be sitting here getting sober. Well, anyway, so I got into working the steps. I finally did get a sponsor after somebody gave me Cindy's name up in North Atlanta and met her, and we started working the steps. We did a tremendous amount of 12-step work. I am so grateful that I had the opportunity to be in on that. And I'll bet you, two or three times a week, we were going to a 12-step call someplace. And I just love it. Al tells the story, and it's my favorite story about 12-step work, is that I got a call one Sunday night. Now, Al comes from a real teetotaling family. Never had a drink. Never took a drink. Very anti-drinking. So we had made the decision that we were not going to tell them that I was in the program. So anyway, they're up visiting us for the weekend. It's 12:30 at night, Sunday night, pouring down rain, terrible rainstorm, and the phone rings and I get a 12-step call. So I get up and I get dressed and I go out the door, and Al's dad's looking at him and he's looking at that, and he says, "Where's she going?" And so Al told him the truth and told him that I was going on a 12-step call to help another alcoholic woman. And he just thought that was the most wonderful thing that he had ever heard. See, we can just be so off base on how we think, our perception of things. And he, from the time that he was in this world, he came to every open AA meeting that he could get into. He set up the chairs. He made coffee. He did everything. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me my third year chip and proceeded to tell his story, how he had never had a drink in his life. And the audience just cracked up, you know. But anyway, it was a wonderful experience. And just goes to show, you know, he was just so happy for us and happy for the family. So anyway, my sobriety started, and it was wonderful, and I loved it. And then we began to have some problems with the children, which we had not had before, and I want to talk about this really quickly. We found out that Lori, the middle girl, was heavily involved in drugs and alcohol, and she became a runaway, and we did not know where she was most of the time, and it was horrible. It was just heartbreaking. And we did find her, and we had her arrested and involuntarily committed when Parkwood was still here in Atlanta. And I was at my meeting and stayed for the business meeting at Clarkson, because you just did not go to your business meeting. So they asked me at the business meeting, would I serve the group as the GSR? And I told them I was awful sorry, I had too many personal problems, that I could not, you know, do any service work. And one of the old guys got a hold of me and took me in the corner and talked to me about service, and he talked about the wonderful energy that we alcoholics have, and we do have great energy, but it just really needs to be directed in the right way. And he said service was a great outlet for the energies of the alcoholic. So I bought the deal. I served the group as the GSR and went on to do the DCM, and had the wonderful opportunity to serve as the alternate delegate and the state delegate of Georgia, and loved it, just loved that service stuff. Just got really hooked. I'm a service junkie. I really think it is the answer. I mean, if you're having a rough time and you're down and you're doing anything, you just find some service to do, and it will take you right out of where you are. It seems to me every time I had something personal go in my life, that God gave me another opportunity to serve, you know. And then I went on and had that wonderful opportunity to serve as the trustee for the Southeast area up on the board in New York for 4 years. And what an experience to be up there and see the total picture of AA and how it works. And the growth that has happened in this fellowship in 75 years is just unbelievable. I mean, 2.5 million alcoholics sober today. Our literature has been translated into 75 different languages. And, I mean, that, what a message in a very short period of time, 75 years. So a powerful, powerful spiritual message. So I am so grateful to have had that experience. And now that I come back to my home group, about the only thing left that I get to do, they let me make coffee, and they let me lead meetings, and let me do workshops, and I do a lot of workshops and stuff like that today. So I am so grateful for the opportunity. I think the most exciting thing about all of that is the opportunity to learn. I mean, you cannot be in that level of service and not learn about the traditions and not learn about the concepts. So I have been so blessed. Al was not getting any better. And at five years of sobriety, Cindy and I decided we were going to divorce Al. She used to hate that when I'd say that from the podium. She said, "You shouldn't say that from the podium." I said, "Well, it's true. You and I decided we would see a lawyer, took out papers to divorce Al." Now, the day before Al was to sign the papers, Al had what they thought was a heart attack. And he ended up in the hospital in Augusta. And the doctor had told me that I needed to be very gentle and kind with him and not cause him any trouble. And, of course, I'd made up my mind now. We got a guy in my home group that says, "Man, when we are ready to go, we are ready to go." And I was ready to go. And I went in there and, in my kind and loving way, said that I hope to hell he didn't think that that changed my mind about what I was going to do, that I was onward and upward. And he was laying there so helpless and so hopeless and with all kinds of gadgets running in and out of him and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, but I told him I felt sorry for him because he never went back to that job after that. Never went back again. Didn't even go back and clean out his desk. But he came home, and I told him he could stay at the house until the insurance had paid. Because, of course, he didn't have any insurance. Now, I don't know why I didn't know that the insurance would have been paid anyway. But anyway, it took 10 months for the insurance company to pay. And in the meantime, somebody really wise gets a hold of him and tells him, leave me alone, stay away from her, stay out of her way, and you get yourself to Al-Anon and you start putting your life together. And that's exactly what he did. He went to Al-Anon and put his life together. And he's got an absolutely wonderful story. I have 3 minutes left. I want to tell you about my music real quick. I'm a jazz pianist, so I don't need to tell you where I go to work, where I have to go to work. So several times after I'd been sober quite a few years, I really wanted to go back to work again. And I talked it over with my family and with my sponsor, and they said as long as it didn't interfere with my sobriety, it would be okay. Well, I tried it twice, and both I'm a great lover of the bar scene. I love the clinking of the glasses and the mirrors and the bottles and the different size-shaped glasses and everything and the music and what Bill described as the camaraderie coming from the... I love that. I couldn't make it. So I had to quit both times. And then when I was 15 years sober, I wanted to go back again, and I went back. Somebody said, why don't you go on down to Underground, to the jazz, Dante's Jazz Club down there. And Al did a little promo work for me and went down there and talked to him for me, and I went there, and I worked there for almost 12 years. And it was just, you know, I was where I needed to be. My feet were on the ground. I knew I was in God's territory. Every time I got on that piano bench, I declared I am God's territory, using my gifts that God has given me to use. And it was wonderful. Well, it's almost 25 after. I am so appreciative of the opportunity to be with you tonight and to share with you and to hear Katie share. And I love you all, and I thank you so much for my life. Thank you.